Good afternoon, everybody. It's Patrick from the Poison Pan, and we're here with another of our virtual events today. And today we have a doubleheader Poison Pen Press event. We're here with Jeffrey Seiger, and this is the paperback edition of his new book, A Deadly Twist. There is a special hardcover edition coming, and we will be getting hardcovers fairly soon, I think. And then this is David Wagner's brand new book, To Die in Tuscany. These are really handsome covers. They're doing a nice job with these designs. Very cool.
They are. And, let me add that Jeffrey is signing our hardcover copies of A Deadly Twist, but they're going to be delayed probably until May. There was a production issue, and then they have to go to Jeffrey, and they have to come to Scottsdale, and, you know, it takes a little while.
I'll put a link, though, in the comments field for both of the books for anybody watching if you'd like to order copies. And as usual, I'll be kind of behind the scenes here monitoring the comments off screen. So if you have questions for David or Jeffrey, go ahead and put them in, and I'll pop up towards the end of the program and ask some of those questions. So Barbara, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. Gentlemen, what a pleasure to see you both. Why don't we start out by reminding everybody that your first novel in your two series has been reissued with new covers and some other interesting stuff. Is there a reader's guide and an introduction? I think there's some new material. So David, your first book was A Cold Tuscan Stone.
Right, Cold Tuscan Stone. So in this last one, we returned to Tuscany to a certain extent. But yeah, Cold Tuscan Stone, it does have an introduction by the author, me, and then readers group, guide, questions, and then my usual, of course, background on food and wine that I put into every book, thanks to your suggestion.
Which makes them really fun. Now, I see, I think of David as not just a travel author, but really people who read cozies would love his books. They're not cute and they don't have talking cats or, you know, other things, but the crimes tend to be, shall I say, gentler, David, or mostly off screen. There's a lot of art history, architectural history, as well as glorious food and drink. And so I think that a wide range of readers will really enjoy them. Jeffrey's slightly harder. Jeffrey's a little bit tougher there with the crimes, right? You have but they're wonderful. And actually Mykonos is a place where the rich and often evil hang out. While it's not in every book, Jeffrey, it is in your first book, Murder in Mykonos. How long ago was it that we published that?
My God, were they recording those days? Let me see, that was probably about 11 years ago.
Exactly. And when we got it, it was the number one bestseller in Greece. And remains, I think most of your books, if not all of your books, have remained number one bestsellers in Greece. And part of their charm, as with David's books, is they take you to different parts of the country. David tours around Italy, and he was a foreign service officer there, so he spent time there and really knows it. And Jeffrey, you just hung out in Mykonos. I don't think I can give you a dazzling profession. You just like hanging out on the beach with all those women.
Well, I have to say that I'll never have to ask myself the question when the final clarion call is called, say, Jeffrey, don't you wish you had spent your better years of your life living on a Greek island? I'll never have to regret that question.
That's no, it's true. That. You really like that. So you have a long and intimate acquaintance with people in Mykonos. And of course, as we all know from crime conventions, people who hang out in bars tend to be very current in all the gossip and crime. So A Murder in Mykonos, that's when I first began to call you Cassandra, isn't it?
Yes, it was. I preferred that name. Other names I've been called, so thank you.
And why is it that I call you Cassandra?
Because for some strange reason, I happen to predict what's going to happen many times, what's going to happen in Greece years before it happened. I predicted the rise of the last prime minister years before he was elected. I predicted other things to have happened there. And I don't know how I do it. I really don't. It's, as I said recently, it's sort of like I walk into a room and I see everybody having a shoe on their ear. And now I know that shoe doesn't belong there. So I say, that shoe doesn't belong there. I may not know where it's supposed to go, but I know it doesn't go there. And the people say, wow, what a genius. He knew we're not supposed to wear shoes on our ears. I mean, that's how I look upon how I come across these these things. And you were talking before about introductions to books. I had the glorious pleasure of having Tom Perry do the introduction to the reissue of Murder and Mykonos. And I get a smile. Tom Perry was the very first person I ever did an event with. I did it courtesy of Barbara out there. And he's just a great guy. But I remember first thing we did was went to a library, and there were like three people there, including Tom and me. So it wasn't exactly a big one. He says, get used to it, this is what happens. And then we came back and did the performance at your place. And he was very generous. He spoke first, and I started to speak, and he interrupted me and said, and I thought it was rather rude of him. He said, forget about it. I read his book, it's great, read it. So I said nothing more to say. He's just a wonderful guy. So that's what launched my ability to tour, by meeting nice people. And I said, this is a great crowd to hang out with. And David, despite being with David, I agree with it yet.
Actually, if I remember right, I sent you and Tom to the bar at the Hotel Valley Ho, where you stayed till like 4 a.m. So a friendship was born at the Poison Pen. But the thing about Jeffrey's books that's interesting, one reason I call him Cassandra is not only does he predict things that are going to happen in Greece, but all of the books echo back to ancient themes in Greece. So Murder in Mykonos really has to do with religious mania. It's a serial killer novel, but you definitely, and it spends time in Mykonos, but then it floats whatever, like 40 yards offshore to Delos, which was, a religious center and so forth. So anyway, both these books are great. And both of them, you can, if you've never read the series, you get an opportunity to hear from the author and have book discussions. And they're both suited, really brilliantly suited to book discussions. So David, I'm trying to remember, is this book 7 that we are doing now, To Die in Tuscany, or is it book 8?
It's book number 7.
It is, lucky 7, woo.
And I'm glad I didn't wear those shoes on my ears today. So I would look, yes, book number 7.
And we've gone back to Tuscany. And interestingly enough, there's a British author, once again having a blank, who recently published a book in which the murder in England takes place in a botanical garden, which seems like a somewhat unusual setting. But in To Die in Tuscany, again, a botanical garden features in your book. But you are in the hometown of Raphael the painter, right?
Raffaello di Urbino. Yeah, Urbino is his hometown, and he is their most famous native son, even though he spent most of his time in Rome and died in Rome and is buried in Rome, much to the chagrin of the people of Urbino. But yeah, that's where he was from.
I remember when we were editing your book, you had some photographs and you sent me one of the street and the house where Raphael was born. So how did you come to spend time in Urbino yourself? Because when you write, I always feel that you've definitely spent time in the city that you're plunging your story into.
It was one of those places that you kind of have to go to. It's a little bit off the beaten track. It's kind of hard to get to, but it's well worth the effort. It sits up on top of a hill. And if I can work this right, I might make a virtual visit.
Ooh.
Let's see if I can go there. By golly, look at that.
Look at how awesome. You should keep that behind you. It's better than your chair by a lot.
Yeah, it's much better. I wish I were there. But yeah, it's one of those places you go to. The castle, which is right behind me here, making me look like Cornuda or something here, but is now a museum. And a lot of the action takes place in that museum. So it's kind of a place, if you get to Italy, you should really go to Urbino. It's really a nifty town. It's a university town too. So it's got all sorts of great stuff. So it's
Where is the botanical garden located?
Fairly, yeah, everything. Yeah, I mean, it's Italy. It's kind of like Greece, I assume. Everything is close by in these towns. So you can walk to everything. There's a saying in Italy, a misura di uomo, which means that a town is the measure of a man, meaning you can walk anywhere. And Urbino is certainly that way, although it's very hilly. So the people that lived in Renaissance Urbino had good lakes. They
Well, it's a fortunate thing for Rick Montoya, your protagonist, because since he eats and drinks a truly shameful amount in all of your books, you know, he's a runner. And fortunately, when he's in a landscape like Urbino powering up and down the hills, he can kind of keep even, right?
Right. And he does run every morning during this book, every morning of the, what is it, 3 or 4 days the book takes place. My books always seem to be about 3 or 4 days. I guess maybe that's my attention span issue. But yeah, he does make his usual morning runs.
He does. But we'll come back to it, because one of the interesting things about this book is that some of the players in it are not Italian, but are rather visiting. And also art is very important in this book, but not the art of Raphael, as it turns out. So we'll come back. So Jeffrey, A Deadly Twist, your new book, takes us to a really beautiful island. It's quite a neighbor of Mykonos, is it not, Naxos?
Yes, it's very close. It's about an hour by boat. It's the largest and the greenest island in the Cyclades. And that's the locale for it.
And what's happening now? You know, your guy, Andreas, who we first met in Murder in Mykonos, was there as the police chief, but subsequently he's moved to Athens and risen in rank. Although in one book, if I recall right, I'm trying to remember which one, he actually turns down a promotion because he doesn't really love the politics. And but they're very heavy in Greek policing, as they are probably everywhere. Especially, policing is a tough subject to talk about right at the moment, now that I think about it.
Yes, well, he was the chief of police on Mykonos before he went back to Athens to take over his squad. And at one point, as things evolved, he became essentially the minister, the secretary, depending on how you look at it, in charge of all police. He didn't like that position, so he gave it up in the next book. Besides, he could be more involved as a cop. He can't really do much as a minister. So that's where it was. Naxos itself is a fascinating place. My books, as you know, all focus on a significant issue confronting the contemporary world. And in this case, you have Naxos, which is a place which is naturally beautiful. It has endless beaches, beautiful mountains, reasonable, really warm people, reasonable prices. There's all the things that you want to find. And it also has a group, an active group of preservationists who are constantly trying to find the right balance with those seeking to expand tourism. There's obviously a lot of people interested and are hungry for a way to take advantage of Greece, of Naxos' natural beauty and its, the magic of its ways. So you have that yin and yang, which is an issue confronting virtually every tourist place on Earth today. They all have to deal, tourism versus maintaining the past. It was a natural for my book. That's why that was the issue I'm addressing. And it was a natural to do it. Because when I do the books, as you know, the primary goal I have is to entertain the reader. And Naxos gives a lot of chances to do that.
It really does. I mean, you know, Greek has a difficult contemporary history. I mean, economic problems, political problems, and so forth. And in this book, there's people in Naxos still have memories going all the way back to the Second World War, because Greece was occupied. I'm trying to remember, was it the whole country, Jeffrey, or was it mostly, trying to remember, Salonika? I know Salonika was a big issue because Philip Kerr wrote about it in one of his books.
Well, Greece was occupied, but in some places with many Italians occupying, but Greece was occupied. It was terribly devastated. I mean, Greece was the country in which Churchill said, Greeks don't fight like heroes, heroes fight like Greeks, for the way they were able in 1940 to have kept the Germans from moving in. It was really the Italians, to keep them from being able to take over Greece, and were supposed to be 2 weeks. They held them off. Required the Germans to come in, which affected their ability to invade Russia. It's got off their scheduling. So the Greeks were devastated. They were really punished by the Germans for that, punished by it. And sadly, after the war was over, they didn't rebuild Greece. They rebuilt people who didn't side with it. And it was something that took a hard time to come out of. Then you had the civil war between the loyalists and the communists in Greece that ran for about 4 years. And there's a strong history there, and then there was a dictatorship from 67 to 73, I think. So there's a long history there of activity. And you also had, you had violence. You had groups that were out there doing assassinations and that. There's a lot there to work with.
There's a lot there to work with. Yeah. Well, Greeks have long memories and many of them are very long lived. So, you know, we're kind of getting to the point where the few people who were active in the war are probably in their 90s, Lord, even older than I am. So who could believe that? But it does give you a lot to work with. But let's go back. Let's go back to Urbino. David, you, although Raphael is the painter in question in terms of being the native son, in this book, some of the mystery revolves around a different artist. Who's that?
One of my favorite Renaissance artists, Piero della Francesca, who worked mostly in Tuscany and has actually a couple of his more famous paintings are here in behind me in the museum. But he was from Sansepolcro, where the story starts, because a drawing, which was a study for one of his paintings, which is actually in Sansepolcro, it goes missing because it was going to be donated and it goes missing. And it turns out the donor has been murdered, and he was murdered up in Urbino, which is up the road from Sansepolcro. It's getting a little complicated here with these various places, but most of the action takes place in Urbino.
Well, but in several of your books, there's always a satellite, you know, city or something. And in fact, in your next book, which I think is wonderful, you go to Assisi, but you also have a brief moment in Palermo in Sicily, but then you have a side plot going on over in Pisa. So, you know, sometimes you give us more than one destination to enjoy while we're reading the book.
Yeah, that's the case in this one. Even though most of the investigation takes place in Urbino, Rick Montoya and his trusty girlfriend, Benta, they have to go back down into a couple other little towns where there's a possibility of finding out who has the missing drawing. So yeah, you move around. I mean, there's a lot to see in Italy. It's great.
And even more food opportunities. So exactly. We should mention that Beta, Rick's girlfriend, fortunately works for the Italian art squad, the fraud squad. So that's very helpful when we need a crime or we have an artistic background. But tell us a little bit about Rick, because he's an unusual character since he's half from Santa Fe and half his family came from Rome. His mother's family's Italian.
Mother's Italian. Father is an American diplomat, right? What you know, right? A diplomat from originally from New Mexico. So Rick has relatives on both sides of the Atlantic, and he works as an interpreter. His mother made him bilingual in both, made sure he was bilingual in both English and Italian. So he works as an interpreter, and that's what gets him around to various towns around Italy. Because he has to work and he works as a translator and people hire him in various towns very conveniently for the author here.
Well, it is convenient indeed. And he has an uncle who's a high up policeman in Rome. So increasingly, right, as Rick is wandering about to, you know, crimes occur and then either his uncle or the local police think that it would be helpful to have him translate because there's a need for people who don't speak, you know, to cover the people who don't speak Italian in the book. So in this case, it's people from Spain, right? If I remember right, it's been a little while since I read it.
This one's been a while since I read it too, I guess. Yeah, in this case, Beta invites him along, his girlfriend, because the guy who's going to donate this painting and eventually ends up dead is a Spaniard. So, Rick also, he's actually trilingual, because he's from New Mexico. You have to speak Spanish if you're from New Mexico, right? So he ends up translating from Italian to Spanish and Spanish to Italian in this case, which is first time that's happened in the book. It's kind of fun.
It is fun. And actually, in your next book, it's fun because a person from Santa Fe, a school friend of Rick's, comes into play. And that's you have a little bit of that in your book set in Rome. But I really enjoyed it moving forward. But he's an unusual character. So let's go back to Jeffrey. So Jeffrey, what's the status of journalists in Greece? I mean, they do some really great work, but are they often in danger? If you're an investigative journalist, does that put you in the spotlight with some bad people?
You remember you called me Cassandra? I wrote about Nicoletta Urlia and the risk she had here. 3 weeks ago, a key journalist was assassinated in Athens. One of the leading investigative journalists, a hit squad, no question about it. And they're not sure who did it, but he was investigating the quote, Greek mafia and some other things. So I guess the answer to your question, if we look at it currently, is yes, they are in trouble. They are in trouble. That happened right after. So there's Cassandra.
It is. So what happens in Naxos to kick off this particular mystery?
Well, what happened is that Nicoletta Ilia is dispatched by her editor to investigate the simmering conflict between the advocates for greater tourism and the passionate preservationists. And so she goes there and she meets a fan of her writing who claims to be the underground internet's most successful black hat hacker. He takes credit for several suspicious deaths that Nicoletta had reported on and thought were actually murders. So he was essentially the murderer that she had thought he was. He swore that he'd given up his past and asked her to write an article on him so that the world will know that people like him are out there. Common, ordinary people who are paid to do horrible things as part of a calculated plan that is supposed to, at the end, show no guilt or no motive, no links back. He published the article, and 2 days later, her editor called us to say, could you get someone out there to investigate her sudden disappearance and also the discovery of a dead male body at the bottom of a cliff outside her hotel, which is why that cover has a cliff on it. He sent Johnny Kouris over there, his assistant, and Yanni starts following leads and he's turning up bodies. And that leads to Andreas coming over with his family and his whole team getting to work over there. And as a result of the corruption and the difficult times that are going on, they end up in the path of a killer who's going to do anything to keep certain secrets buried forever.
I really like the fact that Yanis gets to have a lead role in the book because, you know, Andreas does have a squad and there are several people in it that we get to spend time with. And it's fun when one of them gets, a greater share of the investigation and we spend time with them. Trying to think, was it in Sons of Sparta? Which one was it in Sons of Sparta that wound up being basically the boots on the ground?
That also was Yanni.
It was.
We know who's going to be in the next one, who gets the time in the sun, that in that next book. But you're right. Each of these people, each of the characters, I think they have their own fan base. They really do. People like Yanni, people like Maggie, people like Andreas, people like Leela. I mean, so, and Tony, who is Kouris's girlfriend, and they give you a range and a perspective of the way you address a problem because each one has their own strengths and weaknesses. And you can work that into the storyline. That's how I see it. And God willing,
it works very well. And since Andreas is married well, he isn't subject to much in the way of economic pressure because his wife comes from a very rich and very prominent Greek family, which is how they get to live in this apartment within a view of the Acropolis, which I have to say, I wish it were real so that I could go and, you know, cage a room for a night or two. But anyway, it does leave him in a stronger position than a lot of people would be, because he doesn't really suffer. He's not worried about economic repercussions. So that, you know, that's always helpful.
The only one criticism I ever received on my book was by someone who said, "You make the cops too nice." That's the feeling. But he's right. He's insulated from that because he has that sort of a financial circumstance. That does help him. And the apartment does exist. The friend has it.
So I have a question for both of you, which is, when you decide on a story, what do you think of the story and then find the location that fits, or do you decide you want to write a particular location and then the story sort of evolves from that? What happened in Urbino, David? What is it that drew you there?
Before I answer that, let me comment. Being a writer, the first chapter or so is so important. So when I read a book, I see how good the first chapter is. And with Jeff's new book, he really grabs you and draws you in immediately with the journalist and with the guy with the hacker and stuff. I mean, it's great. But anyway, to answer your question, I always start out with picking out the place, because in my books, probably like Jeff's, the place where it takes, it's like another character. So it's kind of important. Then after that, I figure out, well, let's see, what would be a good murder to go along with the place? So maybe I'm doing it backwards than most people, but that's always the way I've done it.
I don't think there's a right or wrong approach. It's just, you know, since it's so important to both your books, where in the country you decide to spend time, your time and our time eventually, that it makes sense to me that you might pick the place. But I also think there are stories that fit one place better than another. So, you know, Jeff, a couple of your stories really could only take place in a particular part of Greece. And so what's your answer to that? Do you fit the story to the place or the other way around?
What happened, well, it's hard to say, because the place, I write about places I know. And so oftentimes the place will inspire me, and I'm not sure what the story is going to be yet, because I'm one of those see the pantser writers. I start to write and I have no idea what it's going to be like. So I start in that area. Other times an idea hits me and I follow the idea as opposed to the place, and they sort of come together. But primarily I would say, I think of the place first, because it's a place I know and I can see how it can work. It's a mutual admiration society with David. This is our third time we've done this gig together, by the way. It's so important to have the place be a character that people can feel as though not only are they getting to see it and being immersed in it, but they're being immersed in it as you would through the eyes of a local. That's key. This is not a tour guide. This is your part of the countryside. That's the key to this, as I see it. So whatever I'm writing, I have to feel that way. I just have to feel that way.
That's interesting, because David's next book actually has a tour group, an American tour group, and we see Assisi through the eyes of the tour group, which I thought was really an interesting way to approach it, David.
Yeah, that was fun. And it does draw in the whole Santa Fe, New Mexico thing in kind of a fun way. Since you know New Mexico well yourself, I assume you enjoyed that part.
I did. No, it was great. And I think it's only fair that Rick's paternal half, you know, shows up in one of the stories, because, you know, he's much more linked to his mother's family by being in Italy. So both of you really love surprises. I think that Jeff started out that way, but David, I think that you really have evolved into a tricky plotter. And I do, you know, I mean, I remember we had a discussion about your second book where I thought that I had let you down because I didn't think that the plot was, as it turned out, perhaps deep enough. And that was really on me, not you. But as we've moved along, I think you've gotten to be extremely tricky. And in this book, I was truly surprised the way this plot progressed. I wish we could talk about it, but we can't, obviously. But I like the fact that you brought in these characters from outside. And the other thing I really enjoyed was that you take us inside the museum. I mean, museumology is one of my particular passions. I never go anywhere without going to museums. And in this one, you really take us inside this major museum in Urbino, because this whole question of the painting, you know, is it authentic? Is it being donated? And all the rest of it is so important in the book. Have you spent time in that museum?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a great museum. I mean, it's huge. The castle, as you can see behind me, is a huge castle. The museum is one small part of it, but still it's a huge museum. And it's got some great stuff in it. I mean, of course, you can say that about any museum. But it is a national museum. It's the Museo Nazionale delle Marche. So it's a nationally connected museum with the cultural ministry. You know, you mentioned that the Spanish connection. It was kind of a work in honor of my mother. You notice that my mother was had the dedication in the beginning of the book. And she was, half of my aunts and uncles are born in Northern Spain, where this main character comes from. So that's why I worked a lot of the stuff in Asturias. So that was kind of a thing for me that was, you know, it's almost emotional. My brother read the book and he said he got emotional when he saw the dedication to my mother. So that was kind of fun.
Well, the Spanish family's dynamics are really interesting. And it was also interesting because Rick is the non-Italian in the books as a general rule. But in this book, in fact, it's the Spaniards who are also, we're seeing Italy and what's going on in part through their eyes. And so they too are outsiders. And that, you know, that creates a different look. And Jeff, you brought some outsiders into your books as well. Sometimes really ugly heavies, but sometimes perfectly nice people. And in fact, you're very enamored with the American piano player who works in the bar on Mykonos and has become Yannis's girlfriend. And that character started out in a different book, didn't it? Because, we had that discussion and you brought her into this book and I think she fits beautifully there.
I've written a standalone sort of, and we decided not to do it. So I literally rewrote the book, but with this character because she appealed to me so much. And that book was Mykonos Mob. And it was natural for her to take a part in this next one because she had become involved with Yanni. And so she's a terrific character. She was also, her father was in the Foreign Service. So it was an homage to you, David. She's quite a character. And I felt like I didn't have Americans in my book. So I figured I'd throw one in. See how she flew. She flew very well.
She did very well. Am I remembering that the Mykonos Mob has been republished as Island of Secrets?
The paperback version is Island of Secrets.
Right. So, just for those of you watching who might be wondering where the Mykonos Mob is, the answer is it's now called Island of Secrets. Yes. So you can enjoy it. Why don't we call Patrick up and see if he's got some questions or comments? He'll come back. Here he is.
Indeed I do. Let's see. Okay. Well, you may have already talked about this, Jeff, but David says, do you have your next book location scouted out yet? Can you give us a hint?
Is it okay, editor, to give it a hint? Well, my ex-editor, to give hints, I would say, yes, I have it. It's going to be in Icaria. Icaria is the island also relatively close to Greece. It's in the northern Aegean. And it is known as the island where the people forgot to die, because there are 1 in 3 live into their 90s, and they're one of the 5 blue zones in this world, which means people there live for unexplained reasons far beyond that of the rest of the world. And they have many centenarians, people live over 100. And it seemed the proper time to write a book about age, considering what we've been through. So that's, yes.
That's I'm going to add that some years ago, I'm pretty sure it was in the New York Times magazine, but there was an article about Ikaria and about, I think he was an American, a Greek American, who was diagnosed with cancer and decided, as he, I think he had no family, or anyway, he went back to Korea where he was from and settled into life there and miraculously began to thrive and eventually beat his cancer. There was a lot of comment about the lifestyle of the island where, you know, people just woke up when they felt like it, no alarm clocks, you know, they walked a lot. It's a very mountainous island. They ate, you know, real food all the time, no packaged food and whatever. And so that's a big question. There's so many centenarians on Ikaria, but the question is, you know, is it something in the genes or is it just that the lifestyle of the island, which is really kind of an old one, is helpful? So it was fun. It was fun to, you'll love the book. I thought it was terrific. And maybe because we're both getting older, Jeff, maybe that explains why Ikaria had such a hold. David, you will love it. Recipe. But on the other hand, the kind of food and drink that Rick indulges in, I'm not terribly sure he'd survive that in Korea.
It was an impoverished island where people were, for 100 years, they lived in these rugged mountains. So the pirates and the conquerors couldn't find them. Literally, it was the century of obscurity, they called it. They lived it. Because every time someone came from the sea, they either slaughtered them, stole them, or raped them. I mean, that was the country. It was considered one of the most impoverished islands in Greece. And all that comes together in the book. We got another book to talk about. We got to talk about this one.
Right. Well, you always have to leave readers.
I like them all. In fact, what happens, I don't know if it happened to you, David, but having worked for, having written Deadly Twist some time ago, and I then wrote, was immersed in this book. In fact, I'd written another one as well. Then when it came time to get ready for the book tour, I said, I'm going to read a Deadly Twist because I'm going to get my plot lines all confused. Yeah. I've asked about it. So that's what happened.
You always want to leave readers expecting a new book and excited about it, which is, you know, just call it pre-marketing. All right. So Patrick, another question?
Yeah. Let's see. Our good friend, Lisa Holstein. She says, hi, Patrick. Would you ask Jeff to talk a little bit about his lovable villains? In several of his books, I've ended up rooting for the villain. And then she says, the ending of A Deadly Twist is terrific. And tell him I send love to his Barbara.
I love you, Lisa. I don't know who I'm looking at on the screen here, but I love you too, whoever I've seen in my eyes. I've got to tell you that I love villains. I really do. And it's really kind of someone, Lisa say that. And I don't know, they just grow. The one that comes to mind, first of all, is Teacher. Teacher was this woman from a rather rough background. She appears in a couple of books. And another one is a fella who appeared in that as well. And Karin, his name is borrowed from the ferryman who would take you from living to death. And every one of them just seems to have their own personality. And I like them, I really do. I actually want you to like my villains. I mean, you want them to have a dastardly end, but I want you to like my villains. If I could write a book just with villains, I might do that. But they're fun. They really are fun. In this book, the villain is interesting. I approach it at a different level, a different way. Because this book is all about things aren't what they appear to be. That's the whole point purpose of it. Things aren't what they appear to be. And we'll see how the next one goes. Even Ikaria has its own villain. Villains are important to me, and I'm glad that Lisa appreciates it. I'm gonna call the next one, maybe Holstein. Yeah, that's right. I'll call the next one Holstein.
The next villain?
Yeah.
As an homage, that'd be great.
Well, that's kind. Thank you.
You can name him Patrick Holstein.
That's a great name. That's a great name. I'll do that. Patrick Holstein, that's really good. We'll see what he'll do. All right.
Patrikios.
Yeah, Patrikia. No, this I tried to do another. The other book I wrote, which is not based in Greece so much, I don't find it. At least not yet. It is more. It has a character which is more like a George Smiley, Sherlock Holmes, The Equalizer. that character. That's another. That's a fun thing. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'll be quiet. I'll go to my room.
I've put out a call for more questions, but have you already answered? Forgive me if you've already answered this question, Jeff. But when did you first go to Greece?
About 35 years ago, a little more than 35 years ago.
What took you there?
A friend of mine, she said, we love it over there. I did love it over there. In fact, when I got off the plane, I felt, my God, I'm home again. I really did. And the first day we were in Mykonos, I walked past a jewelry store and a guy invited us in. I figured he was in a house list to buy jewelry. And so happened, he just was being nice. He was a very smart guy, market and all that. And we became like best friends. And he happened to be the most respected guy in the island. I didn't know it. We became really good buddies. And in fact, he passed away. And Tasos, in my books, is an homage to him. This is the name of Tasos. The Moulis, the book is Stamatis, but it was that. So I became part of the family. I felt like I was like, from the first day I was there, I was part of the island. It was a real, real lucky thing. The fates took me there.
David, how long were you in Italy with the Foreign Service? Because obviously you were in several.
Yeah, we had three assignments, total of 9 years. 3 years in Milan and then two different times in Rome for a total of 9 years, almost 10. But anyway, you know, it's kind of like what Jeff said. In Italy, it's the same thing. It changes your life. I mean, if you live in a place like that, you look at everything differently. You look at food differently. You look at sort of this lifestyle differently. You obviously look at art history. You look at history differently because they got real history there. That's why I love to fold all of those kind of things into my books, because that's how you're changed when you live in a place like that.
Have you watched Stanley Tucci's series about eating around Italy? It's really fun. I've watched Naples, the first one in Rome, and then I got sidetracked by other things, but I'm going to go back to it. But he really takes a deep dive, doesn't he, into the local cuisine.
I wasn't sure what to expect, but he does a great job. It's good, and he gets into a couple restaurants that I know, and of course he eats a lot of food that I know. And I think, and I forget which one it was. I think it was the Milan one. He eats pizzoccheri, which is in my second book. It ends with them eating pizzoccheri, which is this special kind of pasta. No, it's a great series. And there's going to be more, I think, right?
I think so. And he's one of those really annoying people who's tall and thin and appears to have a metabolism that works 14 times faster than real people. So he can actually eat his way through Italy without gaining an ounce. Whereas if it were I would suddenly have looked, you know, well, it's very frustrating. But yeah, I think he's terrific. He has a great presence. He was in, wasn't he Julia Child's husband? I'm sure he was. A really good movie about Julia Child.
Oh, you mean the actress? You mean in the movie?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, he played Julia Child's husband in whatever the film was. And that's actually one of the first times I saw him, and I thought he was great. And that was all about food too, or at least a huge amount of it was about food, but French food. And Patrick, you're not pulling out your phone to, you know, help me out here, because you're so good at it when I go blank on stuff like that.
What is it now? You're looking for the actor who played Julia Child's husband?
Right. Stanley Tucci was cast in the movie, and it was really a good movie, but that, again, very much centered on, I'll tell you what, you ask a question, I'll look it up on my phone for a change. We'll just swap roles here.
Okay. Jeff, forgive me again if you've already discussed this and I missed it. Have any of your books dealt with, kind of harkened back to a story dealing with Greece during World War II? And what was going on in the islands? It seems like it was kind of a tricky, because there's so many islands. Is there any case that deals with it?
I actually thought of doing a book based on that, and Philip Kerr did his. And another time someone else did, and I said, I'll let it slide. Oh, the islands were deeply affected by it. People starved and died, and they had to repopulate them in some cases. It was a very difficult time. And it's strange because it makes me understand a lot. We talk about the tourism. Mykonos today is like the playground for the rich and famous. I mean, it's amazing difference. It was the poorest place in Greece. in World War II, they came out of, they suffered, they died. And that generation, the children of that generation as well, they have seen this transition to go from utter poverty to the point where it is now billionaire row. And I don't really grudge them anything they're doing because they went through it. They're entitled to live that life as they do. It'll be interesting to see how the next generation does, thinking this is what it's always like. But it's been amazing, the sudden change from the end of World War II to now. It really has been for them. By the way, a plug for this gentleman. Well, I guess David, I'll just say, I don't know where you appear in my fingerprints. If I'm not in Greece, I'm in Italy. I'm 100% with him. It's just wonderful. In fact, the last place we were before the world shut down was Tuscany. We were in Chitona. But it's really a great place. Really love it there.
So I've done my magic on Google. The film was Julie and Julia. And in that film, he played Julia Child's husband. And the current thing we're talking about is Stanley Tucci in Italy. And each one of them is like David's books. He goes to a particular location and then he eats and drinks. Anyway, it's a lot of fun for those of you not traveling at the moment. And Julie and Julia was an interesting movie because it was about Julia Child and then a woman aspiring to be a chef. But Stanley Tucci, I thought, was the high point of that, even though I think Meryl Streep played Julia Child, if I remember right.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, it was great. So Patrick and I have a thing going. When I can't remember anything, he uses the chat function to remind me, because as we all know, our memory is not what it was, right? So kind of hard to do that. Anything else in the way of questions, Patrick?
Diane DiBiase says hi. I'm not sure if she's still watching, but let's see. Any specific questions? They're notably silent. I think they're just enjoying the presentation.
Okay.
I was going to ask a little bit about Michael Dibden. Love his books. And David, was he a source of inspiration for you at all?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's the great. Whenever people ask me what other books based in Italy, crime books I should read, I always mention Dibden first, and then Donna Leone, and then Andrea Camilleri. Mm-hmm. But going back to your question about World War II, and in I think it's my third book, the thing of the partisans comes in, you know, former partisan or partigiano, as they call them, is worked into the plot. And that was one of the things I found fascinating when I got to Italy. I think I was in Milan for a year before I met somebody who actually admitted that he was a fascist, because it seemed like most of the probably get the same thing in Greece. From that, you'd think, well, the whole population was up in the hills fighting as partisans, which I always found kind of interesting. Everybody claimed to be a partisan and never, you know, in the fascist party. But anyway,
true in France, where they all belong to the resistance, you know, there's a lot of rewritten history once the war is over. For sure.
Those heroes fighting like Greeks, I mentioned before, there was a problem in Greece after the war. There was a concern on the parts of the powers that Greece would go communist. So the partisans who had fought the hardest, when I get smacked by some Greeks for saying this, were said to be the communists. They were organized to really fight. And they were not followed up and treated the way they thought they should have been treated after the war, which led to the civil war. It came after that. It was, but the bottom line to your question earlier to me is I've not written about that per se.
So one of the big takeaways from this whole conversation is you can see how much fun these two authors have had writing their books. A chance to, in David's case, revisit Italy. How long has it been since you've been back to Italy, David? Has it been a while?
Yeah, it's been years. Even before the pandemic. You know, unfortunately, to get to Italy, you have to get on an airplane, as you mentioned earlier, before we went on, we were talking. And it's no fun to get on an airplane. So I haven't been back now. It's been a while.
So for you, it's revisiting and having a wonderful time. And for Jeff, who's hoping to go back to Greece this summer, you know, you're still experiencing it. But both of them, it's interesting, both of them are relatively small countries, but so rich, not just in history and food and all the rest of it, but little individual regions of these countries are so distinctive. You know, I mean, it's all Italy, but Tuscany and Umbria and, you know, Sicily and all are really different. And the same is true in Greece with the different locations that Jeff writes about.
Same race.
So, you know, it's fascinating to have a chance to go in depth into these countries. So, you know, you can read the books for enjoyment, but they're also a great preparation for, you know, in the after times, which we hope are coming, that you can go and travel there.
Yeah, the great, that's one of the great things that I always tell people about Italy is the regionalism.
Yeah.
Every region is different. And within the regions, they are small, and they don't like each other within the same region. There's a term in Italy called campanilismo, which means a campanile being the bell tower, and you had loyalty to the town within the sound of the bell that you heard. So everybody is, you know, very tightly connected with their town. And when you get a few miles away, a few kilometers away, well, those are those guys. But it makes it fascinating.
It does. Is there a
strange place where you can actually hear both competing bells?
Good point.
At the same time?
Probably.
You know, the problem is that most tourists are whipped through all these spots. You know, you go from one to the other with the speed of light and you hit the highlights. I mean, I was 15 when I first went to Italy. And I remember, you know, it's like two nights in Rome and one night in Assisi and a nod to Perugia and on you go. And you really do need to spend time. You know, if you can plan it, it's better to spend several days in one place and then several days in another. But often that's hard to do. So these books give you a great opportunity to do that. So guys, it was wonderful to visit with you. Thanks so much for your time. And I guess we'll be looking for a new book from each of you in 2022, right? Meantime, To Die in Tuscany and A Deadly Twist. And if you've never read any authors, pick up A Cold Tuscan Scone, A Cold Tuscan Stone by David, and read the introduction and so forth, and then read Murder in Mykonos by Jeff. And lucky you will have 7 books by David and 10 books by Jeffrey to enjoy, which is a wonderful way to spend some time while we're all shut up at home. So thanks, guys. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you,
David. Good to see you again.
Have a wonderful weekend. And thank you all for spending time with us this afternoon. Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.